This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about last week's multiple raids on activists' home across the country.
It's part of and perhaps an escalation in the chilling attacks on political activists in the United States.
We'll hear about several recent disturbing death penalty cases.
The United States remains one of the few, quote, civilized countries in the Western world to maintain the death penalty, which it has in 36 states and in federal law.
We'll hear how a federal appeals court threw out a human rights case against Shell Oil. Apparently, a multinational corporation that engages in gross violations of human rights, from torture to kidnappings, can no longer be sued for such violations. Corporations may be people for giving money to campaigns, but they're apparently not people when it comes to serious and gross human rights violations.
Stay with us.
Heidi Boghossian, you're the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, and you've been following this story very closely. As you know, at around 7 a.m. Friday, September 24th, agents of the Joint Terrorism Task Force of the FBI barged into 8 homes in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Chicago, Illinois, breaking down doors in a coordinated raid against leftist activists. Agents seized papers, computers, cell phones, and personal items of Hatim Abudaya, Joseph Iosbaker, and Stephanie Weiner in Chicago, and served Thomas Burke of Chicago with a subpoena ordering him to appear before a grand jury investigating, quote, material support to terrorism, end quote. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, agents raided the homes of Meredith Abbey, Mick Kelly, Tracy MoMA, An Thu Pham, Jessica Sudin, and the offices of Twin Cities Anti-War Committee. FBI spokesman said that, quote, interviews, end quote, were being conducted across the country. No arrests have been made or charges reported, yet about a dozen activists have been subpoenaed to appear before a federal grand jury whose proceedings are secret. Heidi, put this in context for our listeners, please.
Michael, these raids are actually not surprising. Over the last decade, the National Lawyers Guild has witnessed a pattern of government intimidation of activists, ranging from infiltrating, spying on peace, anti-war, and other political organizations, targeting individuals whom they perceive as lead organizers, so that before national special security events, for example, the 2004-2008 Republican National Conventions, we saw FBI agents and members of Joint Terrorism Task Force going around the country, visiting activists at their homes, visiting their families, going to their place of work, asking them questions about their political views, whether they plan to attend the conventions, sending what we call a chilling effect on free speech. Other tactics we've seen take place at these mass assemblies, such as the RNC and the DNC, where police engage in a wide range of really fearful activities, not only the use of less lethal weapons against passive crowds, but using horses, bicycles, motorcycles to push crowds to then trap, detain, contain, and then mass arrest without probable cause, meaning that they're taken off the streets, out of the sight of the media, out of the sight of the delegates, detained for often days with no charges, and then released. Many individuals are charged with anti-terrorism laws, and that's the trend that we're seeing and that these raids are a part of, vilifying domestic activists. And the Supreme Court has a body of case law that supports vigorous language such as shut down the convention. We've been seeing that for decades. All of a sudden, such words and even ordinary household objects that are picked up in these raids become, oh, the makings of a Molotov cocktail. Police and law enforcement are ascribing evil intent to political literature, political jargon, and household objects. In these recent raids, I think we have to look at the recent Supreme Court decision in the case Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project. And that means that any politically active entity or individual who provides what they call material support, and it can be in the form of legal advice, the writing of an amicus brief, humanitarian aid, any kind of dialogue, even if it's aimed at coming up with peaceful resolutions or ways to work together, that becomes a terrorist activity.
Remember that Lynn Stewart's issuing a press release was material support to terrorism. Heidi, what's your take on the level of government where these recent September 24th raids originated? My thinking is that they happened in Illinois, they happened in Minnesota. This wasn't a local decision. It must have been a decision that went up at least as high as Holder, the Attorney General, and maybe in consultation with advisors in the White House, perhaps even former constitutional law professor President Obama. Have you thought about that?
There's no doubt that this originates from the top. This comes from the Oval Office. This is now a hallmark of the Obama administration. One of the interesting developments is that at the same time as these raids took place, the Obama administration announced that it was supporting new regulations to compel popular internet messaging services like Facebook, BlackBerry, to open up their systems to FBI surveillance. This was reported right after the raids, and one may wonder if the raids are also a distraction for pushing through this kind of legislation that more deeply erodes our fundamental rights to privacy.
I think it's ominous. There was discussion last month about their ability to turn off the internet so that those of us who had hopes about the internet being this marvelous way to organize, you know, unless you have meetings where you actually physically rub shoulders with people, we could be in a lot of trouble because they turn off our lights.
Michael, I think it's worth noting also that we see greater repression on the part of the government at times when the popular movement begins to have measures of success. So, for example, we've seen the creations of domestic anti-terrorism laws aimed at shutting down the very successful animal rights welfare movement in this country, the environmental movement. Laws that were particularly designed to penalize actions that are related to those two groups. Why? I think because they've had success.
I think you're absolutely right. Look at the three sorts of groups that were targeted in the September 24th raids. One of the people, Abu Daya, a Palestinian living in Chicago, was the head of the Solidarity movement in Chicago with the Palestinian people. And this is coming just at a time where more and more Americans, and particularly more and more Jewish Americans and younger Jewish Americans, are disgusted with Israel's policy towards Palestinians and want to change. A second example, the Twin Cities anti-war movement against the escalating war in Afghanistan and the fake pullout from Iraq and the drone bombings in Pakistan. This excellent group of anti-war activists in Minneapolis gets targeted.
Now, we saw that under the Nixon administration. We had the same kind of crackdown on domestic dissent. We had the use of grand juries as fishing expeditions to gather personal information rather than to seek an indictment. We had raids. We had the vilification and labeling of activists as subversive entities. We've seen the use of informants, and I'm going to mention the case of the RNC 8, which happened during the 2008 RNC in the Twin Cities. Individuals were arrested, their homes raided, materials confiscated on the basis of search warrants that had been based on informants' false information. What happens? Then these individuals are caught up in the legal system for two or more years. That in and itself is a disruption of one's life, costly, even if they get lawyers who donate some of their services. It still brings an enormous cost to their lives and their immediate community. Now, in a positive development, but I think it's telling about where these indictments come from, recently charges were dropped against three of the so-called RNC 8. There are four remaining who will stand trial on October 25th of this year. But I think the fact that the charges were dropped is an indication that there really was nothing other than rhetorical speech, shut down the convention, and good organizing on the parts of these individuals. And I should remind you that these individuals did nothing other than organize. And The police are saying that one or two acts of vandalism or property damage that happened at the RNC are the direct result of that, and they tie them in under state terrorism laws to riot. But we see this, what I think is preemptive punishment that sends a chilling message of, if you are an organizer, if you have literature that calls for people to take action, you risk arrest under severe anti-terrorism statutes, and you risk having not only your life ruined, but the specter of decades in prison.
And the movement that you're part of being sidetracked and depleted in its effort to defend you, and you risk having your computer taken and downloaded, your BlackBerry, same thing, the list of how your organization raises money and who gives it, same thing. This is what they ripped off when they went into these various homes and offices on September 24th.
Well, they're building enormous data banks and what they call terrorist watch lists. And the government itself has admitted that a lot of the information on these lists is inaccurate. But there's no way to get your name on it once you're there. And as you know, it's shared widely with law enforcement all around the country.
Believe me, I know it every time I try to get on an airplane. Heidi, when the FBI knocks, what do you do?
It is crucial that if anyone listening to this show is contacted by the FBI, or if your friends or family members are, that you do not talk to them. You just say, I would like to consult with my lawyer. May I have your business card? My lawyer will get back to you. Never say anything, because anything you say, no matter how seemingly mundane, answering a question, do you live here? Is your name such and such? Can be used against you in further grand jury proceedings.
Well, and they go after you saying that you lied to him. Don't talk to him. Call your lawyer. Call our hotline. Get out a pencil. Heidi, give him the hotline.
If you're visited by the FBI, you can call the NLG's hotline. It's 888-NLG-ECOL or 888-654-3265.
Heidi, please repeat the hotline number.
The hotline is 888-NLG-ECOL. And how you can remember that is that originally we started this as a hotline for environmental and animal rights activists. So it was for ecology. It was Eco Law, but we shortened it.
It may be that the government bit off more than it could chew here, that democratic rights are cherished by a lot of people in this country. In the wake of their September 24th raids, demonstrations were called to happen simultaneously in 27 cities across the country. So we can fight back on this one. We can win on this one. We can shame them and hold them off.
I think the response has been great, and it must continue to have a groundswell of support from everyone who cares about protecting their constitutional rights. We have an update that's actually rather good news for a change. A 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on September 5th that Breonna Waters' conviction related to the 2008 arson of a research center at the University of Washington Horticulture is reversed and remanded. Waters has always maintained her innocence in this case. She had been charged with possession of an incendiary device, conspiracy, and arson for allegedly taking part in the arson, and this was based on the testimony of an informant. There are several options now for Waters. She could secure bail pending either a retrial or a plea deal. Since her trial, there is a new U.S. attorney, and the trial judge is actually deceased. Listeners may remember that on June 19, 2008, Water was sentenced to 6 years in federal prison and ordered to pay $6 million in restitution. She has served about 2.5 years of her sentence in a federal penitentiary in Connecticut. The 3-judge panel in this recent decision said that prosecutors should not have been allowed to tell the jury that Waters was reading so-called dangerous literature. An admitted firebomber testified at Waters' trial that Waters had given her a folder full of anarchist writings. One article read to the jury reveled in the, quote, intense pleasure of bashing in the skull of society. Another article called for attacks on the Statue of Liberty, the U.S. Capitol, and Disneyland. It was Jennifer Kolar who testified against Waters. And her testimony had several problems. When she was first interviewed by the FBI in 2005, she only fingered 4 other participants in the arson, and she even gave their aliases, but Breonna was not on the list. A surprising lapse in memory, considering that Waters supposedly drove to the site of the arson on the night in question. It was only later, after she was pressured by government prosecutors, that Kolar named Waters as the lookout. According to the FBI's notes provided to Waters' defense team, Kolar was interviewed 5 or 6 times prior to this identification. While she was trying to strike a plea bargain, Kolar suddenly remembered who the lookout was on that night. In mid-January 2006, she was shown a photo of Waters, who she recognized by name, but did not say that Waters was involved in the incident. It was almost a full month later that she told FBI of the participation. So we'll wait to see what happens in this case.
Heidi Bogosian, I saw you weary and harassed, very busy, at the National Lawyers Guild Convention last week. We just came back from New Orleans, and I thought one of the highlights of the convention was the publication of the short book that you wrote called The Policing of Political Speech, Constraints on Mass Dissent in the U.S. It's a National Lawyers Guild report, and I wanted to have our audience learn about it and learn how they can get it. Tell us a little bit about what's in it and how you can get it.
The report basically contains observations from National Lawyers Guild members, legal observers, lawyers, law students who have been at mass demonstrations, in specific the 2008 Republican Convention in the Twin Cities and the G20 Summit in Pittsburgh in 2009. And what it does is it documents the kind of tactics that we've seen the police use basically to suppress free speech in the streets and to intimidate activists around the country while planning for these events, and then punishing them after on a range of using anti-terrorism laws and charges of conspiracy. As soon as we issued the report, it already became a little obsolete because these raids happened on the same day. But I think that points out the fact that these tactics are really being used on a daily basis to frighten ordinary individuals who are doing peaceful political work around the country, to punish them without cause. And it's a shameful indictment on our administration right now, on the Justice Department. We'll make the report free to anyone who wants it. You can either go to nlg.org and download it, or we'll send you a copy. It has a nice wraparound photo of riot-clad police at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh on the cover. If you send us, I think it's probably $2 for postage, we'll mail you a copy.
Or we'll accept a little more if you want to make a donation for us to send it out to other people. The Policing of Political Speech. You can get it by going online, too.
NLG.org. And you can download it, or the address is there where you can mail in, and we'll mail you a hard copy.
Heidi, I thought that another highlight of the National Lawyers Guild Convention was the award that was given to Mary Howell and the two speeches. She's a civil rights lawyer, long time, 27 years practicing civil rights law in New Orleans, and the speeches she gave about what happened to New Orleans and the resiliency of the people there and how they're trying to come back. But it was really quite extraordinary. She said, first of all, it wasn't a hurricane. The hurricane didn't hit New Orleans. It hit Mississippi, but it didn't get to Louisiana. What happened was that the levee broke, and that's what flooded most of the city. 25% of the population still not been allowed to return. It was kind of a page out of disaster capitalism. They closed down all the public schools. They haven't opened them up yet. They closed down a charity hospital. They brought in the real estate developers and drove out poorer people, which is mostly black people. It was an assault on that population, which was quite extraordinary, and Mary was in the front lines of fighting back.
Mary is an extraordinary individual. She's what we like to call a people's lawyer, someone who's dedicated their entire life to serving the people they work with, to listening to their needs, to be a movement lawyer, and that's what the Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights are all about. But it was wonderful to listen to her, to be down in New Orleans again to mark the 5th anniversary of the events there. And I think you're right, Michael, it was huge negligence on the part of this government.
It wasn't even benign. It almost seemed intentional.
Exactly.
Heidi, another highlight of the Lawyers Guild convention 2 weeks ago was when you got up at the banquet and talked about Lynn Stewart.
Michael, it was the first convention in many years, and certainly since Lynn's indictment in 2002, that Lynn wasn't at the convention.
Yeah, yeah.
And her presence at each of our events, which we hold around the country, has been one of the highlights because she gets up, she speaks, she inspires students, lawyers, newcomers, oldcomers. I read a little statement just so that people would know they should write to her, let her know that she remains in our hearts. We will do whatever we can to support her fight for a new sentencing.
When last I saw her, she said, "Michael, I'm walking out of here." She's irrepressible. Let me give you her address. It's her 70th birthday coming up October 8th, and you can get her at Lynn Stewart, number 53504-054. Repeat, 53504-054, and then MCC/NY, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10007. I'm going to give it to you all again. Lynn Stewart, 53504-054, MCC/NY, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10007. Right, Lynn, send her your birthday wishes. October 8th, she's going to be 70 years old.
One final thing, Lynn, if you're listening, you got a rousing standing ovation and applause. You were with us in every respect except the physical. Last week, the FBI raided 6 homes in Minneapolis and 2 in Chicago, allegedly searching for links to terrorism. The Minneapolis raids targeted anti-war activists, among them Jessica Sundin and Mick Kelly, key organizers of the big march on the first day of the Republican National Convention in 2008. In one Minneapolis home, agents arrived with warrants, searched every room, attic, and basement, looking through CDs, DVDs, books, and photos. Passports, travel, and phone records were among items seized from the homes. The FBI issued subpoenas for the peace activists to appear before a grand jury in Chicago on October 12. The FBI search warrants indicate that agents were looking for connections between local anti-war activists and groups in Colombia and the Middle East. We're pleased today to be joined by attorney, activist, and National Lawyers Guild member Jim Fenerty. Jim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, you've had a busy last week with the raids taking place all around the country. Can you tell us briefly what your role is in this?
Well, my role is, and I'm not the only one. Basically, we're putting a group of lawyers together from the National Lawyers Guild to try and represent people at the grand jury, and if any indictments come out of this, to represent people if anybody is indicted. And so we have been basically speaking to our clients right now about what a grand jury is, how it functions, and telling them they have a right to refuse to testify at a grand jury or not.
How many clients are we talking about?
Well, as of Friday, I knew about 10 people who got subpoenas. As of Monday, I found out that 2 more people in Minneapolis got subpoenas. So far, there's a total of 12 people with subpoenas.
Now, do you think there's a connection between the Supreme Court's decision in Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project and this rash of raids and issuance of subpoenas?
Well, I guess my feeling is that I think in this decision, which I don't know if your listeners know about or not, but anyways, I think it emboldens the government to push the envelope and see what they can get away with here, basically trying to say that certain things that people have done may involve, as they say, material aid to terrorist groups.
Yeah, that's like giving people free legal counsel is material aid.
And we're talking international terrorist groups.
Yeah. Jim Fenerty, what people in Chicago are you personally representing, and what's their political story? Why do you think they're targets?
Well, this is the thing. I was just at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I had another case in federal court this morning, and the U.S. Attorney afterwards turns out is the same attorney on these cases, and he wanted to talk to me. Basically, so far, he has not told me anybody who is actually a target. And so we're concerned what that means. I've been lied to before when I went down to Florida in the Sammy Arian case with somebody else who was involved in that. And they said they couldn't tell me. And I get down there, we take the Fifth Amendment, and they say, "We're not offering your guy immunity, go home." And then a month or two later, he gets an indictment. under their manual, technically, they're not supposed to send out a subpoena for a grand jury for a target unless they get higher authority to do that.
Heidi and I were talking about that.
So let's just explain for our listeners about grand juries a bit. When you talk about a target, you mean an individual who's under suspicion for violating the law.
That is correct.
But what's happening now is that individuals are being given subpoenas in what we call a fishing expedition to try to get information about other people.
That's what it sounds like now, but I really, you know, like I said, that's what they told me. And this happened before where somebody told me something and it didn't actually work out true, but that's what I've been told today. Basically, a grand jury in its inception historically, you know, hundreds of years ago, was supposed to be citizens coming together and determine if charges should be filed criminally against somebody. But what it's become is become almost, to me, almost like a rubber stamp for the government, because basically what happens, the government, U.S. attorneys can be inside the grand jury. There's usually around 23 people who are called citizens to be at the grand jury. And what happens is that the U.S. attorney can be inside. They can ask you questions. You can refuse to answer those questions. But your side never gets told to these 23 people. In other words, your lawyer can't come in there and argue for you and give your side of it. That's why it's, like I said, it's pretty much a rubber stamp for what the prosecutors want. And people should be very, very concerned about going there, because what you say could be twisted around, and you just got to be very vigilant about what you do. You know, most cases, you know, people can say they don't want to testify at the grand jury. They're going to exercise their Fifth Amendment rights against incrimination. What they could do at a grand jury, they could offer you immunity, which is use immunity. It's not total immunity. But what that means is if they offer you immunity and then you refuse to testify, you can be taken to a judge. They'll read the questions to the judge, and they'll ask you to answer that question. If you continue to refuse to answer that question, then a judge can hold you into civil contempt, and you could be incarcerated for the length of the remaining time of the grand jury.
And that can be a long time.
Well, that can be, depending on how long the grand jury sits. But what happens, you know, your lawyer can go back periodically and say, look, a judge, this person has been there for 3 months or whatever, and they're not going to testify. They're still not going to testify. So it makes no sense to continue to lock them up, and hopefully you'll get a sympathetic judge for that.
Because it is lawful to hold someone in civil contempt, to incarcerate them as a method of coercion.
Correct.
But not as punishment.
Correct.
And that's why we try to argue that it's not doing any good.
Yeah, there's not much difference, is there?
No. Do you expect there to be more raids, Jim?
I don't know if there's going to be more raids or not. They're not showing us all their cards yet, so we don't know where they're going with this. But, I mean, there could be raids, but I think that it seems that maybe this is like a test case to see how far they can push the envelope since the humanitarian, you know, aid project case. And so I don't know if there's going to be any, I can't say, but I think people have to be careful, but not so careful, I mean, that they just shut up, don't demonstrate. I really give credit to my friends in Chicago here who've been outspoken and have gone on Democracy Now!, have spoken to a woman from, one of the people from Minneapolis went on Democracy Now!, and they go to demonstrations and they speak out against the actions of the government. So rather than just, you know, be quiet and take it, you know, they're on the offensive, very aggressive about fighting back.
And that's one of the problems, is that this does send a chilling message around the country to activists: look what can happen to you. There seems to be the beginning of a groundswell of really speaking out against these, I think because it happened in so many states and with such secrecy, as you said, and sort of a vengeance. I think people are upset.
Right. But one thing I see here is I've seen some unity I've never seen before in my life, where groups who normally don't get along or have political differences are all rallying around them. And hopefully more unity will come out of this, I'm hoping. But, you know, people who, didn't talk to each other for years are now supporting them because they know they could be next.
That's right. We could all be next.
Right.
Jim, you've been doing a tremendous job. We're trying to get the word out in the National Lawyers Guild about our Know Your Rights information. I think the main message that, as you've mentioned, is if someone is visited by the FBI or contacted, do not speak to them. And the other thing is do not lie ever to a federal agent.
Absolutely. And the thing you have to be careful about when you do speak to them, even though you think you're telling the truth, maybe you don't know the whole story. And you tell something that's incorrect, and they could come back and indict you for that.
That's right. That's why they say don't even answer simple questions like, do you live here?
All you say is, I've got a lawyer. Deal with him. I have nothing to say to you.
You know, I've been doing this for 38 years, but people all over the city have my card, and they would tell me, the FBI came to my house, I gave them your card, and I said, call you. But it's very rare that I ever get a phone call.
That's right.
Of course.
We tell people, ask them to slip their card under the door, never let them in.
Right.
And oftentimes, that's the end of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Is there a way
for
people to contact you or any organization you think that would help?
The people who got subpoenas themselves, they're trying to start organizing, you know, get an office together, maybe have a, you know, so they can get press releases out, raise money. Because if people do get indicted, I mean, this case could go on for a long time.
Mm.
And so those are the things that they're looking at now. I mean, obviously right now, nobody from the Lawyers Guild is charging for this grand jury. Yeah, the organizing is going to go on, and I'm, like I said, I'm proud to say that people are coming together from other organizations who...
That is a tremendous coming together. Right. Just to put it in context, over the last few years, as you know, we've had the so-called RNC 8, the identifying of activists and activist leaders around the country, putting through them through the system under anti-terrorism charges, and it keeps people's lives tied up in the legal system. Then we see the charges being dropped, and we realize it was all a sham. I mean, we knew that in the beginning, but it's a horrible ordeal to put people through. And defense funds rise up, people come together, and I think the pattern now is growing so large that we just can't ignore it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one thing, too, about this case here, some of these same people who got subpoenas were in some of the organizers up in Minneapolis around the RNC.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I've been doing, too, I just got off the phone with a congressman office, Congressman Gutierrez in Illinois. People in Minneapolis are going to ask their congressman up there, maybe it's time now for a new church committee.
Yes.
The church committee, for your listeners don't know, were back in the 70s when it was discovered that the FBI was harassing groups, dirty tricks, infiltrating religious groups, anti-war groups around Central America, especially around CISPIS, the committee in solidarity with the people of El Salvador. And there's a report came out from the Attorney Inspector General's office of the Justice Department just this month about the activities of the FBI in spying on advocacy groups, but it only goes up to the year 2006. So I don't know if anything's going to come of this, but if you have congressmen there, people should contact the congressman and ask for a new church committee to investigate the FBI.
That's a great idea. Jim, could we call it the Fennerty Committee?
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're sure that we're going to be asking you for updates over the next few months as this progresses, so we appreciate your stopping by.
Good luck, Jim Fennerty.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels feet. He called my name and my heart stood still. When he said,
there have been three recent death penalty cases of import in Virginia, Georgia, and California. In Virginia, Teresa Lewis, a grandmother, was the first woman to be executed in that state in nearly 100 years. Last week, Teresa Lewis was given a lethal injection at 9 p.m. in Greensville Prison. Also last week, in a Georgia death penalty case, Brandon Joseph Rode was found in his cell with his arms and neck slashed days before his scheduled execution. The state of Georgia had him sewed up, put him under heavy guard. When he recovered, they executed him. In California, a federal and state court judge refused death row inmate Albert Greenwood Brown's request to block his scheduled execution. Brown and another death row inmate had filed a lawsuit challenging the state's new lethal injection regulations, saying the procedures were improperly adopted. We're joined today by attorney David Seth Michaels. David has represented death penalty clients across the United States in places from Mississippi to Tennessee. He currently practices law in Columbia County, upstate New York, had been down in New York City with Brooklyn Legal Services and with the Federal Defenders Services Appeals. He's a novelist as well as an anti-death penalty advocate. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
There have been two grotesque executions in the South just recently, one of a woman with a 72 IQ and the other of a man who attempted failed suicide. They revived him only to execute him last night. What's your feeling about these?
These are two really horrible, really grotesque, as you say, executions. It makes me think that as the process goes on, we're going to see more and more and more of these horrible kinds of things that just strip us and the people that we're killing of all humanity. Teresa Lewis had an IQ of 72 and was executed by Virginia after Governor McDonald refused her clemency request. And there were some excellent appellate lawyers on the case who worked hard on it and thought they might be able to get clemency, but lo and behold, they couldn't. She waived her right to a jury in connection with the sentencing. They went to the judge thinking that because the two people who had actually done the shooting received life sentences, that perhaps she would receive a life sentence. Unfortunately, the prosecution took the position that she, even though she had an IQ of 72, was the mastermind of this murder. The judge bought that. He said that she was the head of the serpent in this particular case, and then he decided horribly to have her executed, and that's just finally played out. It's despicable.
What kind of deterrent can you have against somebody with an IQ of 72?
Well, there's no deterrent for people with the IQ of 72, and there's no deterrent for people with IQ of 150, because the studies show that there's no deterrent at all. But in this case, it's particularly appalling, as you point out, because of the limited intelligence of people that we are attempting, or that the state of Virginia is attempting to deter. Nobody knows about these things. This murder happened in 1992. She gets executed in 2010. The only reason you or I or anybody else heard about it is because, as a matter of fact, it was just a horrible, horrible story. And it's replete with the usual horrible story things, which is that one of the most marginalized, most oppressed members of society, in this case somebody who is developmentally disabled, gets selected to be prosecuted for a capital crime. The lawyers don't nail it down. Usually when you plead guilty, the deal is, well, we'll plead guilty and you won't ask for death. But for one reason or another, her lawyers didn't nail that down, and lo and behold, it came back and bit her badly, leaving her appellate lawyers with not a whole lot to work with to save her life, and it didn't work.
I know that the state of capital defense attorneys around the country varies greatly, but there's a Georgia Resource Center. Are there many resources for capital defendants?
This is a real patchwork across the country. There are about 36 states that have capital punishment laws, and they've attempted to deal with these cases, however, whoever it is that they deal with them. Many of the states don't have a statewide defender system. Mississippi is one of those. Texas is another one of those. So in those cases, you get whoever it is that you get, not necessarily somebody who knows anything about it. And what you find here is that as the execution approaches, as you get to the parts of this that are the most difficult procedurally, that's where you start to see lawyers from New York and Washington and San Francisco and other places representing these people. But unfortunately, what's happened in many of these cases in the motion stage before trial or at the jury trial stage is so bad that great issues go by the wayside. And so you can have the most talented lawyers in the world that you want later on in the process. They're going to have a hell of a time trying to save anybody's life if the first part of the case is totally screwed up. Add to that decisions in the federal courts that have been available under the Effective Death Penalty Act for at least 30 years now, which are designed that if you don't raise an issue at one point or another in your appeal process, it's deemed to be abandoned. And so you end up with a situation where your options are decreasing radically, and the quality of your initial counsel is absolutely critical. If it's bad, you're not going to have issues that you can use later on. What you're going to have is you're going to have a very, very difficult time afterwards.
With the American Law Institute's change in their stance on the capital justice system, we thought we might see more people and organizations coming out against it. I guess that hasn't happened to the extent we hoped for.
No, I don't think that it's unleashed a tidal wave of opposition to it. There was a long statement that was issued yesterday, I believe it was, by Catholic bishops in California opposing the death penalty in all circumstances. So you're starting to see some of this. Part of the issue we should mention, just in passing, is that California was getting ready to have its first execution in 5 years this week. And Judge Fogel of the federal court in San Jose granted a stay so that their new lethal injection law could be thoroughly examined. He was directed to do that basically by the Ninth Circuit. And now, fortunately, California's one of the drugs that they have to use in their cocktail to kill people has expired, and they can't get any more of it. So according to this morning's newspapers, it's going to be at least a year, regardless of what the court rules or any court rules, before they'll have the necessary implements of murder to kill somebody who's on death row. So they have a kind of de facto stay at the moment that's been in effect since 2006.
Are all states that have the capital punishment using lethal injections now?
There was recently somebody who was shot by a firing squad.
Right, I thought I remembered that.
Utah has a firing squad.
Most states use the lethal injection. There's some discussion at the moment about what the correct drugs are and what the ratios are and how you make that medical and whether you can get doctors to participate in killing people without having them be in trouble with their licensing board for participating in non-life-saving activities. And, you know,
right.
A thousand issues about that.
David, if our listeners want to be further informed or get involved with the anti-death penalty people like you are there a website, an organization they could go to?
Yeah, the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty, NCADP, is a wonderful website, and so does the Death Penalty Information Service, DPIC. And also ACLU has a really nice website in connection with the death penalty, as does the NAACP Education and Defense Fund. So there's four main resources. It's sort of like if you Google or Bing death penalty, you'll get to all of the major organizations that are.
I know you started out doing law down in Mississippi many years ago. And what was it that got you involved in doing death penalty stuff?
It's an outgrowth of things that happened when I was young. The Rosenberg execution for one thing, Carol Chessman for another. And then I got involved when I was in Mississippi in what was going on in the penitentiaries and mental institutions. You know, one thing leads to another. You see these horrible things happening. And then I got into it. But before we go, we should also mention the Georgia incident this week. There was an execution last night in Georgia of a man named Brandon Rode. His execution was originally delayed because he tried to kill himself. He had a razor and he cut himself on the neck and throat and arms. Georgia, at that point, decided that what they would do is they delay his execution so that they could kill him. So after he hurt himself badly, they stitched him back up and they put him in a restraint chair and they increased his security. And then they killed him. So obviously he had no regard for the lives of the people that he killed, which was a man and his two children. And he had no regard for his own life, because obviously he tried to take that. And now Georgia has said, well, you know, the only way you're going to get killed around here is if we do it. So they have no regard for his life either. And so we're back to the place where we've been reduced to his level. We've been dehumanized to the extent that he dehumanized us. It's just ridiculous.
It's clear that a country's death penalty policies is a reflection of how civilized a nation is, and we have one of the worst records in the world.
That's true. I agree with that completely.
David, it's been a pleasure, even though this is a difficult subject, but we greatly thank you for being with us today.
And we thank you for all your humane work in the area, David Michaels. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks. You're very kind. Thanks for having me.
In a real shocker, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the highest federal court in New York, threw out a case on behalf of Nigerians against Shell Oil for serious human rights violations. What two of the three judges on the Court of Appeals decided was that corporations could not be liable in U.S. courts for international human rights violations. Yes, you heard it right. Corporations cannot be liable in U.S. courts for international human rights violations, even such violations as murder and torture. Pretty shocking. Now it'll be up, hopefully, to the full court, all the judges on the Second Circuit, to reverse that decision, or the Supreme Court. The case came out of the 1990s, when the company, Royal Dutch Shell, was accused of helping the Nigerian government of suppressing in a violent and excessive way, protests against oil exploration. One of the judges on the three-member appeals court wrote a strong dissent in which he called the decision, quote, a substantial blow to international law. In a past interview on these very issues, CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Peter Weiss, explained how a 1789 United States statute, the Alien Tort Claims Act, was used to hold multinational corporations accountable for human rights crimes. We're joined by CCR staff attorney Maria LaHood, an expert on these cases and who worked on a variety of cases against Shell for the torture, detention, and execution of Ken Sara Wiwa and other human rights activists and protesters in Nigeria. Maria, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Maria, I want to talk about a case called Kiobel v. Shell, and of course it's Shell Oil Company, and it concerns some drilling in Nigeria and a very bad decision we got out of the circuit court in New York, circuit court being a federal circuit court, around the suing of Shell. As we talk about it, the first thing I'd like to know about is, what was the case about? Who were the people? What are they suing about?
Well, this was a class action brought by the Ogoni in Nigeria against Shell, and it was the parent companies of Shell and then the Shell Nigerian subsidiary. And they brought the case because Shell had been complicit with the military dictatorship in the 90s. They had, you know, been detaining, torturing, killing people, basically to suppress a grassroots opposition movement to Shell's environmental degradation and Shell's human rights violations in the Ogoni region of the Niger Delta.
So our claim is that Shell, in its efforts to get its oil out of the Niger Delta, engaged in or aided and abetted human rights violations.
Right, was complicit with the Nigerian government.
And what sorts of violations?
Well, you know, one of the allegations had to do with one member of the Ogoni Nine. So the Ogoni Nine, or MOSOP was the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people, and they sort of led the movement, not only against the environmental degradation, but against the taking of land without compensation and other human rights violations. So the leaders of that movement were arrested and detained on sham charges, tried by a military tribunal, and then 10 days later executed. They were tortured, and there were 12 named plaintiffs in this case. The allegations were arbitrary arrest and detention, torture, extrajudicial killing, crimes against humanity, international law violations.
So this and the case was brought by them in a New York court against Shell Oil because Shell has a presence here and allowed us to essentially sue them, even though they did the action in Nigeria. Is that right?
Right. It's not Shell Oil is actually the U.S. company, but it is, you know, it's Shell Trading and Transport and Royal Dutch Petroleum, which are the parent companies. And those companies were, the court was found to have jurisdiction over them in CCR's case, WEWA, back in the 90s. So this case was brought actually in 2002 after jurisdiction was shown over the company.
It's a companion case to the Centers case. The Centers case, we were settled, but this case was still continuing against Shell. And I know the statute that we're concerned by is the Alien Tort Statute, and that's a statute I know that's working at the center, that was first really used by the Center for Constitutional Rights to get at international and human rights violations against individual perpetrators, you know, bad guys who did torture overseas, bad guys who did kidnappings, et cetera, overseas. If they came into the U.S., we could sue them. And I guess what happened here, the plaintiffs tried to sue Shell, a corporation, on a similar grounds that we sue, the center often sues both corporations and individuals. And an issue came up in this case that I guess has sort of stunned all of us. Is that right?
Well, yeah, because it never actually came up in the briefing. It just came up when the Second Circuit issued its decision.
Tell us what it is.
Basically, two judges, Judges Cabranes and Jacobs, went out of their way to find that corporations cannot be held liable for international human rights violations. And again, the issue hadn't even been briefed. But so the result is that corporations can profit from complicity in killing and torturing, or even in killing and torturing, but they can't be required to compensate the victims.
Right. I mean, you could go a little farther almost. You could say they could go to I'm going to ask you this. You can go to the Nigerian government and say, we'll help you guys eliminate the opposition to our drilling. Here's the weapons. Here's the helicopters. Here's how to do it. In other words, direct aiding and
Absolutely.
Abetting, if not more.
Yeah.
And then you can't sue the government because they're immune under law. And now under this ruling, a 2-1 ruling, or 3-0 really, it was really 3-0, wasn't it?
Well, there was a concurrence. So a concurrence, Judge Laval didn't agree with the other two judges that there wasn't corporate liability, but he agreed that the case should be dismissed.
Okay, so at least let's say 2-1 on this issue. So you can't sue the government of Nigeria because it's immune. And now under this ruling, you can't sue the corporation. Is that right?
Right.
Now, were you surprised by the ruling?
Yeah, I was surprised, at least that it came down in this case. You know, the issue had been fairly fully briefed in another case, a case dealing with apartheid in South Africa. But that happened a year after this case was heard, and so it hadn't even come up in this case. There is no reason to distinguish between natural persons and corporations for liability purposes. It just doesn't make sense, and there's no basis for it in the law.
If an individual like the Shell person from Nigeria walked into the United States who was involved, and the Shell person who was involved in aiding and abetting in the murders or whatever, then you could sue that person.
Right. And in fact, you know, in the WEWA case, we did sue the head of the Nigerian subsidiary because he happened to be in New York.
I remember it well.
Yeah.
I think you served him at Columbia or something.
Yes, we did. And that was in 2001, and that was before this case was brought. So this case was only against the corporate act, the corporations.
So now we have these bizarre rulings coming out of our country. The corporations are persons for the purpose of giving as much money as they can, as they want, to political campaigns.
Right.
But when you want to sue them for gross human rights violations, including torture, you can't do it.
Right, absolutely.
So I guess they're protecting corporations pretty much.
Mm-hmm. They're persons to be protected and to have benefits, but not to be held accountable.
So what's next, Maria?
Well, you know, the plaintiffs are planning to petition for rehearing. to the full Second Circuit. So hopefully this decision won't stand. This is the first circuit to rule like this. There was only one other district court, and that was just earlier this month. So this is totally new. Unfortunately, I think corporations are going to be submitting this decision in their own cases around the country, but hopefully that won't be successful. And, you know, as it stands, this decision only applies in the Second Circuit, like you said, to New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. So hopefully other courts will not follow it.
When you read the decision, I looked at it right before talking to you. Cabranes, who's the judge who wrote the opinion, is so hostile to human rights people, not just around corporations, but this whole line of cases that you and the center has established on suing for human rights violations against even individuals. It's just hostility. He almost says there's 9 decided decisions in the circuit or something, even though we decided this case in 1980, the original case giving jurisdiction to these types of cases. And he says the reason for that is they're so complex and so complicated and so this and that is that a lot of the defendants settle rather than litigate, as if they settle because it's too complicated for their million-dollar lawyers to litigate.
And so, elsewhere, he says, you know, the ATS has given rise to an abundance of litigation, as if there are, you know, so many cases, which there aren't, relatively.
Yeah, there's very few. They're very hard to bring. They're expensive. Yeah. They're difficult. Right. Yeah, no, it's a really hostile opinion coming out of the Second Circuit, which is the same circuit that established the principle that you could sue for international human rights violations.
Right. Even in the Second Circuit, even if this decision stands, the court certainly left open and confirmed that you can sue individuals. So, you know, even here, if we can't sue corporations, we will be able to sue the CEOs or the officers and directors of the corporation. And you can't then go after the corporate funds necessarily, but there will still be efforts to hold people accountable for human rights violations abroad.
I think you're putting together this case with Citizens United, which is the case on campaign financing. I think you would have to say, Maria, the next time we're born, we should be born as corporations. And on that note, I'll leave you in really the trenches struggling to overcome a bad decision. And, you know, you've been at this for, how many years at the center? 10 years, Maria?
Seven.
So let's hope it gets struck down. But, you know, the courts are just changing dramatically if you look at the decisions. Thank you very much, Maria.
Okay, thank
you.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.